Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 26th of October. A whole series of articles by New York Times reporter Alan Schwartz and an article in Sunday's Week in Review in the New York Times caught our attention. Should you watch football? In games a week ago in the National Football League, there were a whole series of reckless head-high hits. This was fare that recently would have been accepted, and maybe fans would have even said hooray for this, and league authorities would have accepted this. But the Sunday when this happened came in the wake of mounting medical evidence about the perhaps dire neurological consequences of football on those who play the game. Is it morally defensible to watch a sport whose level of violence is demonstrably destructive, the article asks, and where do we draw the line between sport and grotesque spectacle? Alan has written so many articles about football, concussion dangers, the laws in Washington State and in other places that are serving as a template for similar policies, mandating strict procedures for handling youth athletes' concussions. It has also prompted discussion at the House Education and Labor Committee hearings on this topic. What if the brain injuries are so endemic, so resistant to changes in the rules and improvements in equipment that the more we learn, the more menacing the sport will seem? Where will football and its fans go from there? I think that that's swirling around these days, and we are going to talk about it this hour of the program. Many, of course, have young people who play football, or you watch high school football games. People are playing football at even younger ages. What about helmets? Alan wrote a whole series of very troubling articles about the helmets that are used by young athletes, how they're not protective enough, and they're just handed down from person to person, and that's not a good thing. So we're going to look at this whole sport this hour of the program and welcome your phone calls. Alan Schwartz is one of our guests. He is a prolific sports writer and author, currently on staff at the New York Times, and he has written, as I said, many articles on the severity of sports-related concussions, particularly the connection between injury to National Football League players and early-onset dementia. He has won several major journalism awards for his work. And, Alan, thank you very much for your work on this topic. Nice to have you on the show.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Dr. George Landry. He specializes in pediatric and adolescent primary care sports medicine. He is a board-certified doctor in pediatrics and fellowship-trained in sports medicine. He is a team physician for the University of Wisconsin Athletic Department, provides medical coverage for Badger men's football, wrestling, hockey, swimming, and golf, as well as women's hockey, swimming, golf, and softball. And his special interests include concussions in athletes, pediatric sports medicine, pre-participation evaluations, and weight control in athletes. Dr. Landry, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Let's start with your whole series of articles. You've been writing about this for some time now, and what you have discovered about young athletes, Alan, and how they're not very protected and what happens to them after they have concussions is really alarming. You read this and say, oh my gosh, this has to change.
Well, I mean, it's not for me to say whether it should or should not change. I think my goal is simply allowing people to see what is happening, and then they can decide how they choose to handle it, okay? I mean, a lot of people had no idea the number of concussions that were being sustained on youth football fields, and frankly, all sports. Girls basketball and girls soccer have the second and third highest rate of concussions among youth sports. So it's not just a boys' football injury. But people had no idea what was going on, and they also had no idea what the possible consequences were. No one's suggesting people should stop playing sports.
Right.
I mean, that would be ridiculous. It's just that pay attention to when you are so that if something happens, you can handle it better. And there was just so much, there was so much misinformation and so much ignorance, and there still is, of course. I mean, you know, we can't change everything, but I think we've gotten people to realize that a concussion is a brain injury, and you have to treat it as such.
Dr. Landry, what happens when an athlete sustains a concussion, and what are the medical recommendations? What should they be for how soon they can return? How should they be examined?
Well, Alan's right. There's still a lot of ignorance out there. I mean, a lot of people have assumed, and part of this is because of what was written in the past, Concussion was only considered a concussion if a person lost consciousness, and we now know that there are significant brain injuries associated with trauma that does not cause loss of consciousness. And so it's important for families to be aware that when a youngster has a hit to the head, or even sometimes just a change in direction with their head and neck, that if they have a headache, they're dizzy, nauseated, they're not acting right, that's a concussion.
Mm-hmm. There seems to be a change, and let's go to higher level sports, although this may be true for younger kids as well, that the people playing this game are bigger, faster, stronger, as you said in one of your articles, Alan. Does that make it more dangerous? Do you have to be better protected if people are that big?
Well, it's a combination of two things. It's a combination of who plays the game and then how they play it. Football was designed for people who were much smaller and not nearly as fast and, frankly, not nearly as protected in some ways as they are now. And in some ways, the rules have changed along with that. You're not allowed to slap a lineman in the head anymore. You don't have a three-man wedge. You're not allowed to take out somebody's knees. Things have always evolved along with sort of the physics of the sport, the mass and the velocities of everybody. But what's happened here is that players are so protected from devastating skull fractures that they stick their head into a ton of plays and sustain either concussions or subconcussive blows that over time can add up. So it's not – I made the point yesterday with another reporter. I said football itself does not exist. It only exists in the manner in which people choose to play it. And what we witnessed in the National Football League over the past week was a decision on part of the league, for whatever reason, to say we don't want to play in this manner. It's we don't accept that level of danger. Of course, they accept a very high level of danger. But these are decisions that are made by people. It's not football itself.
Well, it was obvious what caused that decision, right? People are paralyzed.
Well, I mean, the young man who was paralyzed, who was most notably paralyzed, was a Rutgers player, was a college player. There was also a fellow, I think it was Lutheran College in Iowa, who got no publicity at all because of the Rutgers kid, had the same thing.
Oh.
But this has been, this has been happening for decades, decades and decades and decades. And we all know some of the stories. Mike Utley, I think, was on the Detroit Lions. Daryl Stingley, of course, for the New England Patriots. These injuries have taken place throughout time. It's just now we have an idea of where the hidden injuries lie, where players who sustained concussions and we never even knew, maybe they didn't even know. Then they end up, with early onset dementia at 62.
Mm-hmm.
That is what I think came as a surprise to a lot of people, up to and including well-meaning doctors.
Were you surprised by that, Dr. Landry?
I was, although we've known about this in boxing. We're only beginning to learn that this is a potential risk. The problem is we don't know how many potential athletes are affected, and we also don't know for sure that it's actually the concussions that are doing it. Some of these individuals were linemen who probably had a lot of what we call subconcussive blows, numerous head hits that didn't necessarily make them impaired, but over years, what does that do to the brain? We really don't understand yet, I think, who's at risk. It's just really scary that, in fact, this is occurring to some relatively young people after their careers.
Alan mentioned the level of danger. What level of danger, and I don't know how we even decide this, can we accept in football?
Well, that's a good question. That's some sort of a societal issue. Many sports have a significant risk. The risk is never zero. I think when you look at catastrophic injuries, as Alan alluded to, football's not alone. There are catastrophic injuries in wrestling and gymnastics, in soccer. Each sport sort of has its own relative risk, if you will. Those are the ones that are sort of at the top of the list in terms of catastrophic neck and head injuries. But I think the other thing that he alluded to is that The helmets are so well made now that players have learned to use their head as a battering ram, and that's dangerous. Spearing was outlawed some years ago, and yet somehow it's gotten away from us, and we've allowed spearing, well, at least until last Sunday, when they reviewed film and said, that's clearly spearing, and we're going to fine those guys.
I think that Alan may disagree with you. Maybe at NFL level, it's a different sport. But you wrote an article about helmet safety that scared the pants off me, Alan. It was scary because of the number of children, 4.4 million children who play tackle football. And you indicated that helmets, both new and used, are not and never have been formally tested against the forces believed to cause concussions.
Well, that's correct. The only standard to which helmets are held relates only to the catastrophic forces that might otherwise fracture the skull. That is why the National Operating Committee for Standards of Athletic Equipment was formed in the late 60s, early 70s. They developed that standard in 1973, and it has not changed meaningfully since then. That is the only standard to which helmets are held. And by the way, NOCSI, the National Organizing Committee, blah blah blah, is actually, you know, the board is populated by, in part, the helmet companies themselves, and its funding comes primarily from the helmet companies themselves. It is these standards organizations, and I don't mean to demean them, it's just a fact of life that these organizations exist to protect against liability, okay?
Sure.
That's why they're there.
Right.
And no one has really been paying much attention to the role that any sort of standards body, governmental or otherwise, has or has not played in football helmets. And so the helmet is really, really good at protecting against skull fractures. Okay, there were dozens of them in the 1960s, and there have literally been two since. But the problem is it protects your skull so well that you're fine about sticking your head in there. And helmets, you see, that's the thing, is in the NFL, when you see a player spear, okay, it's a terrible, terrible thing, of course, and it's very, very dangerous. However, you're talking about a brand-new helmet that almost certainly fits correctly and has been handled as professionally as a helmet can be. The problem is that a vast majority of kids in high school or younger, and as you alluded to, there are 4.4 million of them, about 90% of them inherit a helmet from a previous player. A lot of them do get reconditioned, which means they go through a relatively formal process of sort of being cleaned and made sure that the foam is in there correctly and maybe replaced, or a crack in the shell has been discovered. But it's a pretty slipshod process that a lot of times helmets don't even go through for 3, 4, 5 years. And that's the fault of the school district, by the way. That's not the fault of the helmet. Any school district that doesn't recondition its helmets every 1 or 2 years should probably be sued off its
course. Right, shame on them.
Right. I mean, it's just the way it is. I mean, I know high schools told me, you know, our budget's $300. There's nothing we can do. Well, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, you can't cry poverty when, you can't say, you know what, we can't afford helmets this year. We're just going to play without helmets. Hmm. Well, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's too unsafe. The question becomes whether it is too unsafe to play with helmets as they currently are used, and for that matter, and this is something I'd love to talk with the doctor about, is it now too dangerous? Do we know enough about football to know that it's too dangerous to not play, to play without a doctor or a certified athletic trainer on the sideline? Are we at that point where there just should be medical or training personnel on the sideline for every game? What do you think, Doc?
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir. We need more athletic trainers. I don't think physicians can cover all the games, but I've been doing this long enough to watch more and more involvement of athletic trainers here in Wisconsin, and I think it really has improved the health care of the athletes. Unfortunately, it's difficult for all the schools to hire athletic trainers. I mean, we need athletic trainers at the middle school games.
Mm-hmm.
And or physicians or nurses or, you know, whatever health personnel can attend. I fully support that. I think that would help. I did want to revisit the helmet issue. I totally agree with you that there is a problem at the high school level and middle school level, and especially with fit. A lot of times helmets are not fit properly. A properly fitting football helmet is pretty tight and a little bit uncomfortable. And so a lot of the kids, as the helmet wears, they don't say anything because it's a little more comfortable, but it's not as protective. Unfortunately, we don't have any football data that I'm aware of that shows that fit makes a difference in terms of risk of injury, but we do have data.
It's coming out.
Is it coming out? Yeah.
I have the preliminary data.
Oh, cool. Because we do have data.
It's a fellow Big Ten school, but not Wisconsin.
Right. We have data in bicycle riders. We know fit makes a difference with a bicycle helmet, and I suspect it will prove to be true with football helmets.
Yeah, I mean, there is mounting anecdotal evidence through a study being done. I don't even want to say where, but it is a Big Ten university where the number of they looked at the number of concussions sustained by high school players, and then somebody looked to see, gee, was there a problem with the fit when it took place? And it's a very sort of haphazard way of looking at it, but it's the best we've got. And a good portion of the injuries were sustained in a helmet that didn't fit correctly. That doesn't necessarily mean it was solely caused by the ill-fitting helmet.
Right.
However, it indicated, I mean, it's just that people haven't really been thinking about these things.
Right, which is unbelievable. They should have been. Let's go to the way the game is played right now. You mentioned spearing. I have heard some NFL people say that, you know, this is the way I play the game. I know the risks involved. The audience wants to see spearing. They want to see, you know, they don't say they want to see some level of violence, but they don't mind seeing some level of violence because it gets a replay, because they get more attention, the athletes. There seem to be some athletes, I don't know how many, who say, this is the way we play the game. Don't change our rules. People like it.
Well, the athletes will tell you they're getting mixed messages. And I think there's some, to some extent, that's true. But I think the outcry after the spearing episodes last Sunday were a good sign. In other words, I think people are saying, well, no, wait a minute. If this is that dangerous, we shouldn't allow that. And I think worse yet, is it's not just these professional athletes that are paid so well to do what they do, but kids mimic that behavior. And the kids with the poor-fitting helmet, mm-hmm. the kids that aren't as strong, are going to get in even more trouble by that high-risk behavior.
And remember, they don't have a doctor on the sideline. You know, it's very possible that if the hit between Dante Robinson of, I think it was the Falcons, and DeSean Jackson of the Eagles, the one that got the most attention, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It is conceivable that one or both of those players, had it occurred in high school, one or both of those players might have gone back into the game 5 years ago. I mean, it's staggering, but that's because, you know, there's a coach on the sideline. He's watching the game. He maybe has an assistant coach who's getting the defense ready for the next drive. And you know, no one's paying attention to the kid who, you know, feels like it's time to go back, you know, into the trenches.
Right.
And so... I think the doctor brings up a very good point, which is that even if professional players, and there is some validity to this, know what they're getting into and are getting paid for it, they consider themselves professional stuntmen. Okay, that's fine. But the problem is that kids mimic these guys, and what is good for adults is not necessarily good for kids. And we have laws in the United States to keep kids from smoking, keep kids from drinking, to keep kids from doing things that adults are allowed to do. But football is something that kids do, and they do it in an environment that is not nearly as protective as the NFL level is. I mean, if you could get doctors and trainers and education and just really good equipment on every high school kid, you know, it would be a different conversation. There isn't that, and there never will be that, and so they have to take that into account.
Let's welcome phone calls for our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our guest for a few more minutes, Alan Schwartz, will be joining us, staff writer for the New York Times, who's really on this story and has written many, many stories about the safety of the game and pay particular attention to young people who are playing the game. Also joining us is Dr. Gregory Landry. He's on the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine faculty in public health and is team physician for the University of Wisconsin Athletic Department. What do you think about what has happened in the NFL? What about the way this game is played? Do we accept a certain level of violence? What should it be? What should we put up with? And why in the world wouldn't we want to protect our children with the right kinds of helmets and making sure that there is an athletic trainer, a nurse, a physician on the sidelines for these games? Why wouldn't we do that? We welcome your phone calls. Lines, three lines are open right now if you want to join the conversation. And our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Tuesday, the author of Big Girls Don't Cry, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women. Rebecca Traister will be joining us. The book concentrates on Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, Michelle Obama, and all of those elections, and also Elizabeth Edwards in the elections that they were involved with. So let's welcome a couple phone calls here before we have to say goodbye to Alan. We'll keep taking phone calls. Dr. Landry is with us for the whole hour. Tyler is our first caller from Milwaukee. Hi, Tyler.
Hi. I just wanted to call quickly with regards to the youth football question as far as safety for children.
Sure.
I was just calling potentially instigate a discussion about an education program for coaches. I know there's a lot of training processes that are involved. However, as was previously mentioned, there's not the availability of doctors and trainers for every game. And so I wonder if potentially a movement to get coaches with greater training or with more awareness for headshots and things like that, if that could really kind of change the nature of the game for youth sports, or if that would just be another rule that's kind of put into the backdrop.
Alan?
I think it's, I'll take that one.
Yeah, sure.
I think it's somewhere in between. Okay, I know that USA Football, which is sort of the blanket organization for all of youth football ages 6 to 14, tackle football, they have developed a coaches training program for both concussion awareness, helmet fitting, things like that. And you know, they've made me very aware of that. The only problem is only 70,000 coaches out of, I don't know how many there are, but it's got to be 300,000,
right,
or more. Only 70,000 have actually done it. This is on the website. And you know, I think that education, from what I've learned, education is of course a good thing, but it's indescribably slow.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, education in a coach is not going to solve, you know, a vast majority of the issues that exist. I mean, it's a good thing, of course, but I know some people who believe that the first hire that an athletic a high school athletic department should make after the athletic director, the first person they should hire after that is an athletic trainer. Not
right.
The football coach, not an assistant coach, not the equipment manager, not the volleyball coach, not anybody. It should be an athletic trainer. And I think that would go, I mean, from what I'm told, that would go a heck of a lot further than, you know, a voluntary coach's video.
Do you agree with that, Dr. Landry?
Yeah, that would help. The movement to try to educate coaches is not new. The problem is that there's so many volunteer coaches in the states. It's very difficult to enforce any kind of educational program on them. But I think Alan's right. I think simply getting more athletic trainers involved would help, because then there's somebody there on a hopefully a daily basis to discuss injuries and educate coaches about the injuries.
Mm-hmm. Alan, let me know when you have to hit the road.
I'll stick around.
Okay, thank you. Let's go next to Jim from Fond du Lac. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I'm 58 years old, and I sustained a concussion while ice skating about 6 months ago, and wondering if I do a lot of bicycling. I have a bicycle helmet. Would that be appropriate to protect me in the ice skating venue?
Dr. Landry?
It would be better than nothing. You know, I think traditionally ice skaters wear something a little more protective, like a hot ice hockey helmet, but anything like that would help.
Okay, that sounds
wonderful. I'm not a doctor, so I'm not chiming in here.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And let's go next to Mark from Janesville. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a couple young men go through the Pop Warner program down here, and it's a great program. But I'm just feeling so lucky that nothing bad happened, because all the things that you're talking about is what's going on. The kids march in there, and some volunteer dads slap the helmet on their head, and these things have been around forever. And then it's also, you know, the coach's attitude. These guys are in their 50s, and they grew up in the Vince Lombardi issue, and you get out and play, and the parents are like that.
Oh, sure they are.
I remember watching our middle school principal screaming at his kid on the sideline, who just had a spiral fracture of his leg. It's like, get up and play. And I just feel really bad. I mean, I'm now thinking, like, what I did with Pop Warner with my kids is I'm throwing my kids in the vehicle without a car seat.
Well,
I never thought about it that way.
Well, let me chime in, because I get a lot of complaints from some people about, as you put it, hostess, scaring the pants off people. Okay, I mean, I think that the problem here is one of ignorance, far more than one of ill intent. Okay, of course there are some Neanderthal coaches out there. You know, there just are, in the same way that there are some bad doctors and bad sports writers and bad radio hosts. All right? I mean, that's going to happen.
But we're not in that group.
No, but the thing is right. That what I found across the country is that the volunteer dads and the people in the youth leagues, these are well-meaning people. They really do care. They just don't know what to look for. And because they grew up in an era where no one was really paying attention, they kind of don't really know what to look for. When I watched the helmet fitting exercise in Norman, Oklahoma, these were good people. They really were. They just didn't get it. And so I think that it would be more constructive to look out for just simply ignorance or lack of education than ill intent, because you're going to find a heck of a lot more of the former.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Dr. Landry, because I want to get back to that question of, which is related to what we're talking about, if the audience is looking for tougher plays, plays that have more risk, plays that where there could be more serious injury, what kinds of rules are the players given when they're playing football as to what's an acceptable kind of tackle, what's not acceptable, what crosses the line in terms of possibly harming someone? Are those discussed?
They are, and I think this does come down to some of the coaching techniques. Most coaches now are teaching athletes to plant their head, their forehead, in the other player's chest. Well, it doesn't take much further up to start hitting the head.
Right.
And, part of this occurred.
And that in itself is a desperately dangerous maneuver. If you
right.
hit somebody with the top of your head in their chest, you're going to get a cervical spine fracture.
Right, right. Right.
The Rutgers kid.
The one good thing is that they're taught to always see their opponent, always have your head up. And many of these catastrophic injuries are occurring, as Alan alluded to, when the head's flexed, and that puts the neck at risk. But there are some coaching techniques that are problematic. And again, the players will tell you, boy, you know, when they do one of these head-to-head hits or put their body at risk, they get a lot of reinforcement from the coaches.
Hmm. And what about the audience? Do we want to see that? Are there a certain number of people who think that makes the game more exciting?
Oh, I don't know if I know the answer to that. Obviously, there's some Neanderthals that do. I always cringe when I see those hits.
Oh, yes. Ooh, I do too. Ooh.
I guess it's because medically I know what kind of risk they're taking and that it's a high-risk maneuver. But, you know, I guess, do people like hitting in other sports? You know, ice hockey, boxing? It seems to be part of our culture.
Well, I mean, look at America's Funniest Home Videos. I mean, no kidding. I mean, you know, people falling down, getting hit in the crotch. I mean, yeah. You know, there's a fine line, you know, between you know, entertainment and sadism.
Right.
But the thing
right.
is, we all fall somewhere on that continuum. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember I was actually friends with Charles Schulz, the Peanuts cartoonist.
Oh.
And, you know, of course, poor old Charlie Brown would always lose, and you know, Lucy would always pull away the football. And what he told me, he said, it's funny unless it's happening to us.
Mm.
And, you know, look, the human race is particularly the male half of it, is an aggressive species. okay? I mean, these are natural things. I don't get hung up on judging these things. First of all, I can't in my position as a reporter, but I think just logically, it's a waste of time to judge it. That's a matter of opinion, and people make their own decisions. I mean, when we talk about, you know, increasing your risk for X, Y, or Z, well, when I flew home from Boston 2 days ago, I increased my risk for dying in a plane crash. But I did it anyway because I understand that that increased risk is not meaningful enough to alter my behavior. Now, some other people may view other types of risks differently. They may drive 100 miles an hour. I choose not to. Mm-hmm. I choose to drive 78. Perhaps, you know, doctor, you only drive 66. These are all decisions we all make, and even all make on behalf of our children. But all I hope is to give people the information on which to apply their judgment.
Right. Well, we should all drive 55.
I wasn't going to be naive enough to suggest that, because we all take risks.
Yeah, I see your point. Dr. Landry, you said something interesting when you talked about, you know, what can happen when you see those certain kind of plays. I'm wondering if you watch football in an entirely different way than the rest of us, in that do you cringe a lot when you're watching a game thinking about potential injury because you know what can happen?
Yeah, and I'm trained to look for injury. I'm covering a high school game tonight, and yes, I will watch differently. I'll watch more carefully how the players leave the field, especially after a collision, watching carefully to see how they carry themselves. Sometimes we can tell if an athlete's been concussed just by their behavior, and even before we start talking to them, they're staggering, if you will, or they don't look right. So I do watch games a little bit differently than I think a non-medical person.
And then when you see a player like that, what would you do?
Well, then we go to them right away, start talking to them, and try to assess the severity of their injury.
Uh-huh. Let's go to Susie next from on the road somewhere. Hey, Susie.
Good morning, all. I am actually not involved with football directly. Longtime organizer of a youth baseball program in our community, youth and amateur program. And, I know that choice is important, and I think that it is something that we need to protect. I really understand that point. In our program, we desperately try to limit the use of the curveball until the athlete no longer had soft growth plates. Trouble is, that happens at different times for different players, and then parents have a different idea about what they want their children to do. We always took the high road and made sure that all the risks were made known, and then we had to allow the parents to make the choice. One thing I was frustrated with, just one comment, and actually two comments, I was frustrated with the fact that it was very hard to find evidence or literature with regard to guidelines for the proper use of the young pitcher's arm. I finally found one little booklet that's out of print that came out of University of North Carolina that was excellent. But the lack of that does not make it easy for us to educate our coaches and our parents with regard to making the individual choices. My second comment is, in football, particularly, because of the growth plate situation and the high potential for injury in contact sports in the young children, as a mother whose son played football, I don't see a reason for kids to have to hit until they're in high school. There just isn't that much skill development that can't happen in a non-contact setting, in a touch football setting, and wait till these kids grow up enough to actually hit each other. I'm very glad my son was not interested in playing contact football as a young athlete, and he had a wonderful career as a college baseball player, which might not have happened if he'd chosen to be a contact football player at a younger age.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Susie, very much for your call.
I'd like to chime in real quick. Regarding the evidence of the effect of curveballs on young kids, little league-type players, because of the soft growth plates, I don't have the answer to that. However, a good friend of mine, a former columnist for the Baltimore Sun and Business Week, Mark Hyman, H-Y-M-A-N, wrote a fantastic book called Until It Hurts, where he detailed his own experience of sort of pushing his kid to pitch when he was hurt, and he ended up having ligament transplant surgery, Tommy John surgery, reconstructive surgery on his elbow when he was like 16.
Oh my gosh!
And couldn't pitch again. And it was it's sort of a soul searching book, but also includes a lot of the evidence regarding where pitch counts come from for young people, what the dangers truly are. And I don't think there are any hard answers there either. But anyone who would like to learn more about, you know, how young kids pitch and what it can do and just what to look out for so you handle it better than my friend did, that book, again, is called Until It Hurts.
Until It Hurts. Dr. Landry, what about literature concerning all sports, football and soccer and baseball? Is there a lack of material, as Susie seems to indicate, about the way things should be done? It seems to me as though those kinds of handbooks should be readily available.
Right. And then the other problem we have is that it takes quite a while for the science to trickle down into the trenches. It turns out there is some pretty good data out of Birmingham. And actually, if you hit the web, usually a lot of the baseball organizations now have those recommendations published. And again, pitch count, ages for not only number of pitches, but types of pitches. We've got, you know, more recent information that would have helped guide her. But certainly when her son was young, there were no data. I mean, we were winging it, and a lot of kids overdid it. She made one comment that intrigued me about limiting tackle football until later.
Yes.
And having the young kids play flag football. You know, one of the analogies is in ice hockey. Because we wait and we don't allow kids to check until later. And those are the kinds of things that we can do to reduce risk. We can change the rules. Alan alluded to this earlier in the sport of football. There have been rule changes that, in fact, have helped to prevent injury. And those are the kinds of things that I think we need to begin to think about in terms of how can we change the rules to make it safer.
More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email, and we'll go to a couple of those in a moment. talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Our guest, Dr. Gregory Landry, University of Wisconsin School of Medicine faculty. It's also the School of Public Health, and he is team physician for the University of Wisconsin Athletic Department. Alan Schwartz, staff writer for the New York Times, who's won a number of awards for his work, most recently on football and looking at helmets and looking at whether or not we need to be thinking about how do we protect our athletes more than we do, and also examining possible early onset dementia, et cetera, from concussions sustained by football players. More calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next call is Keith in Appleton. Hi, Keith.
Hi, Kathleen. I've got a question for Dr. Landry and for Al Schwartz, if they are familiar with any research pertaining to the long-term concussive effects of, I'm thinking primarily of two Wisconsin products, NFL players from the 70s and 80s. I'm speaking of John Matuszak from the Oakland Raiders and Mike "The Rock" Webster, all-pro center for years for the Pittsburgh Steelers, both of whom died tragic, despairing death due to brain injury that they incurred during their playing days. So if we're aware of, you know, these concussive effects from the 70s and 80s, using those two as examples, what more research has been done lately on the long-term repetitive impact similar to, like, boxing?
Okay, let's go to Dr. Landry first, and Alan's written about this as well. Dr. Landry.
Well, again, I alluded to this before. I don't think we know what the denominator is. We know that this can occur. One of the things that I want to say about this is that back when Webby and back in the 60s and 70s, people didn't recognize concussions. They just kept playing. I mean, who knows how many they had? Our own Al Toon, who had a brilliant career with the New York Jets, when he was asked when he had to retire early because of recurrent concussions, I think had trouble recalling how many he'd had because they just weren't getting the attention that they're getting now. So I think things have improved. I think the problem is we just don't know what it takes to induce that kind of brain damage. Is it the number of concussions, or is it, again, the subconcussive blows that do it? There's a lot we don't know.
Alan.
Well, to be frank, I think it was a little difficult for me to hear the question. But I think it had something to do with just how players appear to be having terrible problems later in life.
Right.
And with respect to the denominator that Dr. Landry referred to, what's interesting here is that the denominator, and I understand his concern, actually doesn't matter because this is not supposed to happen to football players. So anybody who does have it, okay, it can't happen any other way other than repetitive brain trauma. Now, we do need to know the denominator before we can know, you know, what the true proportion of people getting it is. However, something like 12 out of 14 NFL players who have been tested for the disease, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is the brain disease developing from repetitive brain trauma, quite possibly concussions only, but also maybe subconcussive, we really don't know. 12 out of 14 have tested positive for the disease, many of whom died very very unpleasant behavioral problems. Now, that's not a random sample by any means, okay? But 12 is still 12 more than there are supposed to be. And so we really don't know the true percentage, but the fact that it happens at all, and it was found even in a college player, okay?
Owen Thomas, that was most disturbing.
Yeah, mm. Owen Thomas from the University of Pennsylvania, which happens to be my alma mater, killed himself in April. Now, we all know that suicide takes place on a lot of college campuses, and just because one of them happens to have been a football player does not mean that football was involved. However, they did do an autopsy of his brain, which is the only way you can find out if someone has...
Oops, hello?
Did we lose him?
Yeah, I think we did. You can finish the sentence, I think, Dr. Landry. Yeah. So what we're going to see is probably much more extensive study of brains of football players, and we would hope that we would see some kind of medical recommendation here or helmet changes or whatever as a result of that.
Well, the other thing that leads to one thing, a comment I did want to make about the helmets. It's not just about the helmets. A lot of these concussions occur because of not so much the force of the blow, but acceleration, deceleration.
Mm.
The analogy is race car drivers. Race car drivers are also well protected, but when they're going 200 miles an hour and hit the wall,
they're usually concussed.
Because their brain is, you know, moving in space. And that's the way a lot of the concussions happen in football and other sports. So, yes, helmet fit's important. Yeah, and the criticisms he has of the committee that works on helmets are legitimate. We've known this for a long time. But I have a lot of families who ask, you know, should I buy the new helmet? Will the new helmet help protect my child, especially after they've had a concussion?
Sure.
And the answer is not necessarily. Again, as Alan said, they're made to prevent skull fractures, not just concussion.
Mm-hmm.
But back to the encephalopathy, he's right. Any instance of this is disturbing and you hope doesn't happen. But again, we don't have a very good feel for how often this is occurring. How big a problem is it? We need a lot more research on that
mm-hmm.
topic.
Mm-hmm. And here's an email that's come in. I have a 15-year-old son who dreams of playing college football. His build seems uniquely suited to playing on the line. I have three questions. Is it irresponsible as a parent to encourage a child's interest in playing college ball? How do we reduce his risk for getting a head injury? Are there positions in football that have a higher incidence of head injury?
Well, that's a good question. Interestingly enough, the highest risk positions are on the defensive side of the ball. The hitter is at higher risk than the hittee, if you will, except for certain positions. Quarterbacks and receivers and running backs are a little bit more prone to concussions than offensive linemen. Offensive linemen are not immune to concussions, but they do sustain concussions at a lower rate than on the defensive side of the ball. The highest positions are highest risk positions are defensive backs and linebackers. And actually, that's a very relevant question to those of us that take care of individuals that are getting recurrent concussions, because we try to do some things to protect those athletes from getting further concussions. And so sometimes if they play both sides of the ball, we'll say, why don't you just play offensive on the offensive side, and that will help reduce the risk.
Mm-hmm. Alan, are you with us again?
Yes, I am.
Okay, we lost you sort of in the middle, and I want to know where research is going on the brains of former football players, and if we're just at the beginning with this kind of testing, if we'll see a lot more of it, and then we'll anticipate changes in either the way the game is played or protective gear.
Well, I'd say that, the researchers primarily involved in this, there are two groups. There's the Sports Legacy Institute and the Center for the Study of Chromatic Encephalopathy at Boston University, and also a group at West Virginia University. And it's a very frustrating process, because the only way that they can diagnose the disease, CTE, is after someone dies. And we don't hope that that happens. But you really don't know if somebody's having memory problems because he's getting older. I mean, that happens.
Right.
Or whether it's happening because of football, or whether someone is at particular risk. And there may be a genetic component that leaves you at higher risk for these problems, much in the way that sickle cell has been identified as something which you probably want to find out if you have it, because then you can take appropriate precautions. It's a very frustrating process. Once they do learn about perhaps a genetic component, that will allow people to make, again, more informed decisions. If they find out that, subconcussive blows are in fact at the root of this, well, then, there are a lot of decisions that have to be made. If it's only concussions and mistreated concussions, which is what most of them have always been, basically, except those at the University of Wisconsin and Altoona. I've heard very good things about Coach Alvarez.
we like to hear that.
Yes. But the thing is that, we don't know yet. So all we can do is allow people to make decisions based on what we would imagine to be common sense.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all.
Wayne in Holman is next. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning. Really enjoying this show. I know you're concentrating on football, but a question for both of these gentlemen. Our son played varsity baseball for 3 years, and in his senior year, he was batting 400 in leadoff, so he was kind of a target on occasion. My question is, in one of the games against another local high school, the pitcher had brushed back two previous batters, came in high inside on both of them, didn't hit them, and sure enough, when our son came to the plate, he came in again high and inside. Now, our son bailed and didn't get hit. Now, I thought that kid should have been tossed then. But he came back again at our boy and nailed him right in the head.
Oh!
Thankfully, the helmet took the blow, although he did suffer a concussion and he was out for 2 weeks. But I guess my question to you gentlemen is, do you think that in that case the refs should have come in and said, hey, three brushback and you're out? Or, I think a beanball means if you hit a kid in the head and he wasn't ejected, I think that is automatic expulsion from the game. And
I'm with you, Wayne. I agree.
Actually, let me be a bit of a contrarian.
All right.
Okay. And obviously, sir, no one wants to suggest that what happened was good or that it should continue to happen. Okay. But baseball itself and the way that we play it, one can never legislate beanballs out of the game. Okay. Because, one, they happen accidentally, and, two, by the time they happen on purpose, it's too late. I'm serious. And
I understand.
And the main problem is, and we see this on the major league level as well, is that how do you determine intent? There are times when the ball slips out of your hand and it hits somebody, and that's just the way it goes. Now, what you're suggesting is that 3-in-1 game might point to a little bit of nefarious intent on the part of the pitcher. And that's something that you have to bring up with the league and with the umpire. And if the umpire has the discretion to do that, it's very possible that he or she did not have the discretion to do that. My guess is they did, because three and then one in the head
usually qualifies.
Right.
You know, but there is an inherent risk. I mean, your son, and this is a little different, okay, but nonetheless, your son, who obviously is very good, could have hit a line drive right back at the pitcher, hit him just under the breastbone, and caused what's called commotio cordis.
That's a good point.
And now, I think that generally happens with younger kids, but nonetheless, you know, there are inherent risks to every endeavor, and I think that there was probably no way to avoid that circumstance, because if a kid wants to hit someone in the head, he's probably going to do it.
Yeah. And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Have a good time and watch carefully at the football game tonight, Dr. Landry. Thank you so much. Thanks for being with us.
You're
welcome. Alan, thanks so much for being with us for the whole hour. It was a great conversation. Thanks.
My pleasure. Take care.
Alan Schwartz, staff writer for the New York Times. And we thank Chrissy Pease for producing this hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios, and thanks for all of your calls. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them. We were pretty flooded here. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we will return with more Tuesday morning conversation. So stay with us. A little bit of recent political history following the news.